Philippians chapter, ladies and gentlemen. Anybody know? It's been, you had a few weeks off. You're rusty. It's okay. Chapter 4. Yes, we are into chapter 4. Here's the plan. Let's read the text and then get to work. Philippians chapter 4, verse 1. Therefore, my brothers and sisters, you whom I love and long for, my joy and crown, stand firm in the Lord in this way, dear friends. I plead with Euodia and I plead with Syntyche to be of the same mind in the Lord. Yes, and I ask you, my true companion, help these women, since they have contended at my side in the cause of the gospel, along with Clement and the rest of my co-workers whose names are in the book of life. Paul is wrapping up his letter to the church in Philippi, and after pages of thick, heady, in-depth theology, he says, chapter 4, verse 1, therefore, meaning in light of all that theology, here's one last thing you need to know. And he goes on to say, my brothers and sisters, you whom I love and long for, my joy and crown, stand firm in the Lord in this way, dear friends. Notice the laundry list of names Paul calls the Philippians, right? He says, you are my brothers and my sisters. You are my family. And then he says, whom I love. Now that phrase, you whom I love, is one word in Greek. It's agapetos, where we get the word agape, love. And Paul also uses the word, the phrase, dear friends, is also agapetos, meaning Paul uses the exact same word twice in one sentence. He's saying, I love you. I really, from my gut, I really love you. You whom I love and long for. I'm hundreds of miles away in prison, in chains, and I'm homesick, right? I'm craving FaceTime with you. Long for my joy. You know those people who walk into the room and flood your heart with joy just by being alive? Or that person? There's not very many, right? And Paul says, you are my joy and crown. The word crown is Stephanos in Greek, and it was a word used for athletes in the Olympic Games when the winner of a race or a competition would walk up in front of Caesar, in front of tens of thousands of screaming fans in the Colosseum. Caesar would put a Stephanos or a crown on the athlete's head. The closest thing we have in the modern world is the Olympic gold medal, right? Think back to a few weeks ago in the summer. You know the moment when Michael Phelps or whoever is up on the Olympic block at the awards ceremony and they put a gold medal around his neck and the national anthem starts to play and the flag starts to go up and your heart swells up with joy, you know, and he kisses the gold medal, right? Think of that moment. Paul says, listen, I've got you hanging around my neck. You are my gold medal. You are my crown. I get that because it's the exact same way I feel about you, right? I love you guys so much to pieces. It's been an amazing week praying with you in circles of 3, 4, 5 people early in the morning and late at night and watching your heart for God at work. And man, gosh, it's worth all of the late nights and all of the early mornings. And that's what Paul is saying. You are my reward. In the same way that, you know, you parents, what's your reward for raising your children? Bunch of you keep asking, I don't know. Your reward, that was awesome. And that's at the 8, the godliest gathering, right? Who knows what the 10 a.m. is going to say, right? Oh my goodness, your reward, to answer the question for you, your reward for raising your children well is your children. My reward for raising Jude and Moses and Sunday to walk with and love the living God is Jude and Moses and Sunday, 20, 30 years from now, in love with God, the men and women God intended my children to be. That is my reward, and it's worth all the blood, sweat, and tears. In the same way, Paul says, yes, it's hard work leading the church, and I'm in prison, and I'm beat up, and I'm suffering for the gospel, but you are my Stephanos. You are my crown. You are worth all the suffering because I see God at work in and through you. And then to his brothers and his sisters and his crown, Paul says one last thing, stand firm in the Lord. Now that phrase, stand firm, circles back to the apodasis in chapter 1. Think back to chapter 1. Philippians is written in the template of Greco-Roman rhetoric. And in rhetoric, the apodasis is the thesis in today's language, or the central point Paul is driving home. And the apodasis is found in chapter 1, verse 27. Paul says, quote, live as citizens of the gospel of the king. Then, whether I come and see you, or only hear about you in my absence, meaning if I get out of prison alive and come and see you, or if I die here, right? Either way, I will know that you stand firm in the one spirit, striving together as what? Wake up, 8 a.m. Striving together as one for the faith of the gospel. And at the end of the letter, Paul circles back and says one last time, stand firm. Now that phrase is a military metaphor of soldiers in a Roman army, shoulder to shoulder in battle, right? And he's saying, listen, stand firm, dig your heels into the soil, don't retreat, don't flinch, but stand firm. Now the problem with that phrase is it's ambiguous at best. Right, it's a pep talk, stand firm. And it's great, but the question is, what does that actually mean in day-to-day life? What does that actually mean when you wake up tomorrow morning and go to work? Stand firm, Joel. Okay, what does that actually mean? And what Paul does from here to the end of the letter is he lays out a laundry list of random one-off examples of what stand firm looks like. He says in 2, be of the same mind. He says in 4, rejoice in the Lord always. He says in 5, let your gentleness be evident to all. In 6, do not be anxious about anything. In 8, whatever is noble, right, pure, think about such things. On and on to the end of the letter. Chapter 4 is not a sequence of thought. It's a shotgun blast all over the place. And the common denominator is Paul is saying, listen, here's what it looks like in the humdrum of ordinary life to stand firm and live as citizens of the gospel of the king because we are a colony of heaven. Here's what all of that actually looks like when the rubber meets the road. Now, for today, let's unpack the first example. Look down at your Bibles, 2. Paul goes on to say, I plead with Euodia, and I plead with Syntyche to be of the same mind in the Lord. There are two women in the church who are at odds with each other. That would never happen today. Now, the women are named after the gods of luck and success in the Greco-Roman pantheon. Euodia's name means lucky, and Syntyche means success, and lucky and success do not get along, right? The two women are at each other's throats. We don't know the disagreement. We don't know the nature of the disagreement, but the odds are that the two women were leaders in the church and that the disagreement between lucky and success is causing a ripple effect, is causing factions in the church, and that's why Paul is harping on unity all through the letter. And for that reason, Paul calls the two women out in front of the whole church. Keep in mind that Philippians was a letter, right? And it would have been read out loud in front of the whole church in one sitting. And Euodia and Syntyche would have been sitting right there, right? Epaphroditus or whoever would have been up front reading. Euodia's in the front row, Syntyche's in the third row on opposite sides of the room, right? And he gets to the end. Oh, yeah, great. Live as citizens of the gospel of the king. Great. Hey, Euodia.
Whoa, me?
Yes, Syntyche, you two need to work things out. You two need to get along. And I'm calling you too. And Paul says, be of the same mind. Now that phrase, be of the same mind, is one word in Greek. It's phronesis. And it's the word used all over Philippians. And it can be translated to be intent on the same goal. It does not mean you have to agree on everything. Unity is not uniformity. You may disagree on how to get there, but Paul's saying you need to be intent on the same goal. In the same way that if you and I were to take a trip to Bend or Central Oregon, you and I may disagree on how to get there. You may think the best way is to go over Mount Hood. I may think, no way, Santa Ana Pass is hands down, I think, one of the most beautiful places in Oregon. You hit Sister's Coffee on the way into Bend. I mean, that's the way, right? And we all know I'm right. But it's either Gresham or Santa Ana Pass. I mean, come on, people, right? That was really mean. I'm sorry. And you and I may disagree, and we may go separate ways, but we both end up in Bend. We're both on the way to the exact same place. So Paul's saying, listen, you may disagree about the details, about the map on how to get there, but you need to be intent on the same goal. You need to be the same mind, and he says, in the Lord, meaning you need to both stay focused on the Lord, on the gospel, on the kingdom, and on the church. That means the question is not what's best for me. Yodia, the question is not what's best for you. John Mark, the question is not what's best for you, but what is best for the Lord? What is best for the gospel? What is best for the kingdom of God in your city and through your church? That is the question. And I'm calling you, Paul says, to be phronesis, to be of the same mind, to be intent on the same goal in the Lord. And then he goes on and says, yes, and I ask you, my true companion, help these women. Paul calls in a third party, a mediator. He's a realist. He knows that at times we need help to get along. Am I right? You parents know that full well. It's called parenting, right? You're a mediator. Hey, come on, listen, right? And at times we're like children and we need help to get along. Now, the identity of my true companion is a mystery. Scholars have way too much time on their hands, and there's a whole bunch of theories. Some scholars think my true companion is a name in Greek, like Bob or whatever. Others think my true companion is Paul's wife, because that word companion is used a few other spots in ancient Greek literature for a spouse. Could be, except that Paul was single. It's a minor detail. The majority of scholars think it was Timothy or Epaphroditus, and we don't know. But either way, Paul is calling in a third party to help, right? To get in there and mediate and help the two women work things out. Help these women since, keep reading, they have contended at my side in the cause of the gospel. Get that. These are not bad women. These are not wolves, right? These are leaders in the church who have contended, right at Paul's side, shoulder to shoulder. Paul says, I love you. You are my joy. You are my crown. You contended at my, these are not bad women. That, by the way, is huge, because it shows you that it doesn't matter how godly you are, or your marriage, your family, or your missional community, or your church, you will have conflict in relationships. Am I right? The question is not if you will have conflict, it's when you will have conflict. No matter how godly your church is, or your leaders are, or your husband is, or your wife, or your parents, or your children, or your family, you will have conflict, period, end of discussion. These two women who contended at my side, along, Paul says, with Clement, identity of Clement is unknown, it's a Latin name, a Roman, and the rest of my co-workers, Paul's surrounded by men and women who are co-workers in the gospel, whose names are in the book of life. Now, the book of life was a metaphor used all over the Hebrew scriptures for the people of God. If your name is written in the book of life, then you are in the people of God. And one day at the resurrection, you will stand up in front of God as his son, as his daughter. And it's not by accident. Paul is saying, listen, Yodia, Syntyche, and Clement, and friends, and Philippians, your names are in the book of life. Meaning what? Meaning one day you are all going to stand up at the resurrection as sons and daughters of God the Father, and you're going to live together forever. You might as well work things out now. She's not going anywhere. I'm sorry. Right? Best case scenario, you avoid her for a few decades. She's not going, Syntyche's not going anywhere. Your names are written in the book of, these are not bad people. Your names are written in the book of life. You might as well work things out now. Now notice, Paul is calling Euodia and Syntyche and the church as a whole to deal with the problem, not to bolt. The human tendency, the natural bent, is to bolt. Am I right? When you get into conflict in a friendship, for example, the natural tendency is to go make a new friend. There's lots of people in the world, 6+ billion. Go make a new friend. You don't like your missional community? No problem. We have 135 missional communities. You don't like your church? Don't worry. There are all sorts of great churches all over the Portland area. Seriously. And people move from one relationship to another, from one missional community, from one church to another. Now, there's so much unity right now among the pastors in the city. The last week was a blast. I mean, a ton of my closest friends are lead pastors of churches in this city. And it's to the point now where we joke around about, oh, so-and-so's at your church? That's hilarious. He used to be at my church last year. Oh, really? He was at my church 2 years before that. Or he was an elder, actually, at my church. Actually, he was my, you know, whatever, right? And it's laughable. We joke about it. Tumbleweeds from church to church to church. And that's not all bad. Yeah, what if pastors did that? We were joking about this a couple days ago. What if pastors kind of, you know, I kind of feel like the Lord's moving me on, you know? I'm going to Beaverton Forest Square. It's a great church, you know? And you're there for a year. I don't know. I kind of feel like God's calling me to Mago Dei, you know? God's there. God's at work. Seriously. And it's not all bad, but here's the problem. If you're here because of conflict in a relationship with a leader or from another church, and you're running away from that, you're in sin. And God bless you, but you need to get up as soon as I'm done, and you need to walk out the door, and you need to go back, and you need to make things right, and you need to stay. Because we're all one church in this city. And you do not help the church, and you do not help the kingdom of God by running. But the human tendency is to bolt. From one church to the next church, from one job to the next job, from one marriage to the next marriage. All because we do not know how to deal with conflict, how to work things out, how to love, how to forgive over and over and over, how to see the good in image bearers. We do not know how to deal with conflict. And Paul is saying, listen, we need to learn. Now, I know that scares a bunch of you, but notice what Paul does not do. First off, he does not take sides, right? In fact, he says, I plead with Euodia and I plead with Syntyche. And scholars point out, listen, he uses the exact same word, plead, twice, as a way of saying, listen, I'm not on Euodia's side or Syntyche's side. Paul's smart enough to know there are two sides to every story. You all get that, right? Repeat after me. There are two sides to every story. Right? Yes. When somebody's bad-mouthing so-and-so, church or leader or friend or what, blah, blah, husband or wife, always be thinking in the back of your mind, I wonder what the other side of the story is. Right? That's me. Right? I'm always, whatever you come and download on me, I guarantee what I'm thinking in the back of my head is, I wonder what her husband actually thinks. I wonder what so-and-so actually thinks. I wonder what she's not telling me. I wonder what he's not telling me. There are two sides to every story. Paul does not take sides. Because he's not on Euodia's side. He's not on Syntyche's side. He's on Jesus' side. Secondly, he does not say they aren't justified. He does not say, hey, listen, it's not a big deal. Come on, calm down. No, it may have well been a big deal. We don't know. And last, he does not say they have to be friends and hang out 24/7 and tweet and text and you're my BFF, right? No, he says, listen, you need to be of the same mind, intent on the same goal in the Lord, and do what's best for the church, for the kingdom, for the gospel, for Jesus. But then on the flip side, notice what Paul does do. First off, he does deal with the issue. He does not ignore. He does not pretend. He does not procrastinate. Any procrastinators in the house? No, you show up for church at 8 a.m., but two of you, but... Okay, the procrastinators all show up at 6 p.m. But he calls the two women out. There's no passive-aggressive bone in Paul's body. He's not like, I kind of think in the spirit, in theory, there may be two women who are not getting along. Yodia, Syntyche, get your act together. Come on, everybody, help the two women out. There's no passive-aggressive tactic at all. Secondly, he does call the whole church to help the women work things out. Meaning all of you have a responsibility to work and fight and pray for unity in the church. Really? But if I'm not in the conflict, yeah. But it's none of my business. Well, kind of, and there's a healthy sensitivity. But we're a family. I'm the oldest of four kids. I'm the best. There's me and two sisters, Rebecca and Elizabeth, and then my little brother Matthew. And if my two sisters, for example, Rebecca and Elizabeth, were at each other's throats, right, and not right with one another, I would step in because it's my family. And I have a responsibility as the older brother, as the best brother, to step in and help and Rebecca and Elizabeth work things out, right? In the same way, my friends, we are not a crowd filled with spectators. We are a family filled with brothers and sisters. And we have a responsibility to help one another work things out because nobody's perfect. No leader, no, does not matter. He contended at my side. Great. But nobody's perfect. And we all fall in rough patches. And we all kind of don't always see eye to eye. We have a responsibility to help one another. And then last, he does call the women to see the issue and listen through the lens of the gospel. That right there is the crux of the issue. He does call the women to say, listen, you need to think about not what's best for you, not what's best for John Mark, not about your wounded ego, not about your hurt feelings, with all due respect to your hurt feelings, but you need to see the issue through the lens of the gospel. What is best for the gospel in my city? What is best for the kingdom of God? What is best for this church, for this community, for this family, for my children? You need to get your eyes off of yourself with all due respect. I know that's hard, but that is the way of Jesus. If you're thinking about divorce, you are clearly not thinking about the gospel. You are clearly not thinking about what's best for your children, for your family, for the reputation of Jesus in this city. You need to see the issue, not through the lens of, hey, what's best for me and my happiness? Because you deserve to be happy. Is that true or not true? That's baloney. Seriously, you don't deserve anything. All of life is grace and gift. Every single thing in your life that's good is because God is gracious over you. Happiness is a gift. It's not a right. No, you don't. And here's the beauty. You will find life not when you chase after happiness, but when you chase after Jesus. And when you give your life away and you give your happiness away for the gospel of Jesus, that is where you will find life. In the language of Jesus, whoever desires to save his life will what? Lose it. And whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will what? Find it. That, my friends, is the truth of the gospel. That is counterintuitive. That is not the propaganda that the world screams at you every day in your own heart. Your own heart, which is deceitful at times, your own heart screams at you, but that is the truth of the gospel. And Paul is calling these two women to see the issue through the lens of the gospel, and the same is true for you and me. Now, here's what you have to understand. In order to make the jump from a first century letter written by Paul to the church in Philippi and Iodia and Syntyche, to you and me in the 21st century, right here and right now, you have to understand there are two presuppositions that Paul is writing to the Philippians with. And I'm not sure the same is true for you and for me. First off, if you're taking notes, Paul presupposes that you are in real, true community. The kind of community where you know and you are known, right? The good, the bad, the ugly, where people see through your fashion and your facade to all of your warts and blotches and imperfections, be they metaphorical warts or literal warts. Either way, where people see through. Now, the kind of community where people call you out on your stuff. That, by the way, is how you know if you're in real true community, if people are calling you out. Right? If people are not calling you out, then you're not in real true community. If people are not saying, hey, John Mark, listen, how you spoke to your wife the other night, I don't care if you were tired from 7 days of prayer and fasting. You were praying, John Mark. That's not right. How you spoke to your, that's not okay. And if people are not calling you out, if people do not see the good in you and the bad and the ugly in you, then you're not in real true community. You have friends, absolutely. And you're social, well done. But you're not in real true community. Now around here, for the most part, that does not happen in a weekend gathering. There are a lot of people around you right now. That happens in missional communities. That happens in living rooms and on the streets and in coffee shops and in working for justice in the city. And that happens when you're shoulder to shoulder, not with 1,000 people, but with 5 or 10 or 20 or 30. That happens when you're in real, true relationships. I lived for years without that. As a pastor in a church with dozens of friends, I lived in hiding for years. It's really easy to have lots of friends and not come out of hiding. It's really easy to be social and not be known. In fact, some of the most shallow people I know are hypersocial extroverts. A billion friends, a mile wide and an inch deep. No real, true community. I lived for years with that. And now that I have that in my missional community, now that I have that, oh my gosh, there's no going back. It is life altering. And you were created for that, to live in real, true community. Paul presupposes that you're in real, true community. And secondly, he presupposes that your community is a living display of the gospel. Now, please listen. This whole thing is about the gospel of Jesus. This is not self-help advice for your friendships. This whole thing is about the gospel of Jesus. You need to get that because it's easy to read, hey, I implore, you know, I plead with you, Odia and Syntyche. And, you know, it's easy to read that as watered down, cheap sentimentalism that says, in essence, can't we all get along and sing kumbaya, right? That's not what Paul is getting at. This whole thing is about the gospel. Paul is saying, listen, yes, you need to get along and you need to work things out so that the world that is watching you, and you know that, right? The second somebody knows you're a follower of Jesus at work or in your neighborhood, in your school, I mean, all eyes are on you, waiting for you to drop the ball. And the bar goes up. That's not fair. Well, it kind of is. In theory, you are people that are filled with the Spirit of the living God. You should live different. Am I right? I mean, that's basic mathematics. If the Spirit of the God that spoke the universe into existence flooded your life when you were baptized or whatever years ago, and you are now a new creation, a son, a daughter of God, empowered by the Spirit of God and absolutely remade from the inside out, you should live a tad different than the people around you. Am I right? All eyes are on you. The bar is up, and that is 110% spot on. And you and I need to get along and stay on the same page so that the watching world can look in at your community and see, okay, that's what the gospel looks like. Okay, now I get it. One of the authors who shaped my thinking years ago was a missiologist by the name of Leslie Newbegin. And he was a Brit. He was a missionary from the UK to India, left the UK in 1936, was in India for decades in a pluralist society. Anybody been to India? Beautiful country, colors vivid and crazy, full-on pluralistic or polytheistic, whatever, society. And after decades in India, he returned to the West in, I think, 1976. A crazy story, he and his wife on overland buses with two suitcases. True story. Crazy, amazing man. Returned to the UK, and he was shocked by how much the West had changed in between the 30s and the 70s. In the wake of World War II and the revolution of the 60s, he was shocked to learn that the West was no longer a quote-unquote Christian society, whatever the heck that means, but it's a pluralistic society, meaning the majority of people no longer believe in one God as Jesus. And he was the first thinker to really point out the obvious that, listen, we need to wake up in the West, we need to wake up in Portland, Oregon, for example, and think about the gospel in the exact same way you would wake up if you were a missionary in Calcutta, India, because there's not really that much difference. We now live in a pluralistic society, right? People all the time, well, I believe in God. My question is, well, which one? Seriously, what do you mean by God? I'm spiritual, fabulous. With what spirit, We're in a pluralist society. And he wrote a book called The Gospel in a Pluralist Society. Brilliant read if you have time. And in it, there's a beautiful chapter about what he calls a gospel hermeneutic. And he talks about how a community, how a real true community, how a church, how a family of brothers and sisters, when it's done right, is a gospel hermeneutic. Meaning, people look in at your community, at how you do life together, at how you love one another, how you serve one another, how you forgive one another when you sin, right? How you carry one another's burdens in the language of the New Testament. And people look in at a real true community and say, okay, that's what the gospel means. Okay, now I understand. Okay, okay, I get it. Now it all, Jesus is Lord. What does that mean? Oh, look at how those two love each other. Okay, now, okay, that makes sense. Okay, Jesus is the king of the world. Well, what does that mean? I don't really know. It's a pluralist society. Look at how those three people love and forgive and serve and do life. Okay, now I get it. It's a gospel hermeneutic. A few days ago, my wife was in an amazing conversation with a neighbor a few houses down who is delightful. She's a Buddhist and very kind of steeped in that from birth. She's from Thailand. And they had an amazing conversation about the gospel of Jesus. And it all started because our house was kind of crazy that day. I'm a part of an amazing missional community. It's my family. And the guys in my missional community is a single dad with several kids, dependent kids. And we take care of his kids a few days a week because we're his family. We pitch in, we do that. And the day that she was over at our house, it was crazy. It was our three kids and three more kids and her two kids, right? And our house is not that large, right? And it was mayhem, right? And all week long, she just had a baby a few weeks ago. Our missional community's been bringing her family meals. And she was asking my wife's amazing if you know her, she's way better than I am. And anybody who knows me doesn't argue with that. And she was asking my wife, why do you do this? Why are you serving me? Why do you take care of each other's children? Why do you pitch in? I mean, it's insane. Like, why? You know, and why are you filled with so much love? She said, I see a light in your eyes. Why? I mean, it's a true story. It's like what you read about, right? This is in my living room. Why are you filled with so much love? And Tammy, well, we follow Jesus. And that leads right into an amazing conversation about the gospel of Jesus that ends with her saying, gosh, I want that. I want to be a part of that. That, my friends, is a gospel hermeneutic. Now, it's easy to brag on my wife, right? I could tell you success stories. I could also tell you failure stories about my family, my missional community. But that is a glimpse, I think, of what it looks like to live in real, true community, to do life, to care for one another in such a way that people look in at you. And you're not perfect, but you are authentic and see the gospel in action and think, okay, that is what the gospel of Jesus means. Because your community is a living display of the gospel. Now to end, go ahead and let's wrap up with a few questions. Go ahead, clear off your lap, put away your Bible and your notes, take a deep breath, clear your head. Here's a few questions to think and pray on. First off, is there a Euodia in your life? Or a Syntyche? Is there somebody that you're at odds with that you're not in harmony, you're not in sync with? You need to be of the same mind. So somebody, you need to go and make things right. You need to ask for forgiveness because there are two sides to every story. Don't buy into the innocent victim mentality. There is truth to that, but not always. Is there somebody in your life you need to make things right with? Or are you the third party? Are you the My True Companion? So somebody in your family, in your missional community, in your church, that you need to help out. You have a responsibility to step in and love. Secondly, are you in real true community? Are you? Are you in a missional community? Great. And if so, are you open and honest and transparent? And last, is your community a gospel hermeneutic? Are you doing life in such a way that the watching world says, yeah, okay, now I understand the gospel? Right now, take a few minutes and clear your head and listen to the Spirit of Jesus.